Book 6. Towards Jerusalem. Chapter 1. He steadfastly set his face. Following the eventful days at the Feast of Tabernacles, Jesus returned to Galilee, but not to resume his ministry there, nor need to stay any length of time. He gave his disciples the opportunity of bidding farewell to their homes and families, because Galilee would see them no more until the Son of Man was risen from the dead. Luke, who records the memories of this Jerusalem journey in far greater detail than the other evangelists, describes this final departure from Galilee. And it came to pass, when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. Words which eloquently convey both the sense of dedication and the glory that lay beyond the cross. His time was now only a few months away. His witness was almost over. His voice had been drowned by the clamorous opposition around the populous shores of Galilee. The priests of Jerusalem were watching carefully for the first opportunity to arrest him. Even the Samaritans were about to refuse him. The aspect of Jesus must have changed during these last months of continual opposition. A tenseness begins to creep into the gospel narrative. The joyful days on the shores of the sunlit lake, when all men followed and acclaimed him, had gone. The times when he could sit on the gentle slopes of the hills, watch a great crowd settling on the grass, and speak of the wonders of his Father's kingdom, were quickly fading memories. His words convince us that lines of care could be traced in his face. Resolution, almost fearful in its intensity, shone in his eyes. This change never affected his love and thoughtfulness for those to whom he ministered, but it betrayed the suffering of his soul that becomes articulate in the Psalms. It is with relief that we watch his features relax as he takes a child into his arms, and we feel a glow of joy when we see the hospitable doors of Bethany open to receive him. His journey now takes him through Samaria, Perea, and Judea, visiting many towns and villages on the way, but his goal is always Jerusalem. Nothing remained now but to go resolutely forward and finish the work his Father had given him to do. Now the tenor of his teaching changed. He openly declared himself to be the Messiah of Israel. His parables no longer portrayed the present aspect of the kingdom, but emphasized the day of his return in power and judgment. All men should know him as the Christ, the Son of David, and if they reject him, they must reject him as the Messiah. The last scene in Galilee is one of tender sadness. The Christ of God looked out upon the cities of the lake, Bethsaida, with its busy waterfront and its humble dwellings. Capernaum, commanded by its stately synagogue, its cluster of rooftops gleaming in the sunshine. Away inland to the northwest, the hazy outline of Chorazin. Their teeming thousands had followed him so readily, but their fear of the priests had been greater than their loyalty to him. They had left him with his handful of faithful disciples. They had made their terrible choice, and even their final support at the coming Passover would not avail them. Woe unto thee, Chorazin! Woe unto thee, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. And thou, Capernaum, which art exalted unto heaven, shalt be brought down to hell. It shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for thee. The disciples looked in alarm at this loving master who had suddenly become a prophet of desolation, pronouncing a doom from which these cities could never recover. Gradually his features relaxed. He looked upon these men who stood around him, loyal through many trials. Once more the prophet became the master. Lifting up his eyes to heaven, he prayed, "I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because thou hast hidden these things from the wise and prudent, and hast revealed them to babes. Even so, Father, for so it seemed good in thy sight." The little company looked out over the gleaming waters of Galilee, which Jesus would not see again on this side of the cross, and his disciples not until they had undergone strain and suffering almost beyond endurance. The first shadow of the coming end had been cast by these words of Jesus on the cities of their birth, the scene of their childhood and later of their youthful ambitions and their daily tasks. Once they had willingly left it all to follow Jesus. They had said their first farewell to their dear ones and their homes. They had forsaken the little boats and the lake whose moods they knew and loved so well. They had turned away from the green fields, the waving corn, the fragrant copses of lovely Gennesaret. Now, on the eve of their final departure, their Lord had turned to condemn and prophesy extinction upon this world of happy memories, upon their friends and their homes. It was a severe test for these silent men. They felt baffled and sick at heart. Only the strong and devoted figure at their side could command such loyalty. He felt the aching of their hearts, the emotions too deep to be trusted with expression. He looked at them, his eyes kindling with a warmth of love that left them breathless and showed them that no sacrifice can be too great for him who offers his care and companionship. "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Would they ever forget this last lingering moment before they turned away toward the south? Nor must we forget it. When we are tempted to consider the price loyalty to Christ demands of us, we must go back to this scene, watch these silent men, and listen to the voice of their Master and ours. Can any sacrifice of ours measure up to theirs? Jesus led them away from everything that man calls worthwhile. He directed them to a place of suffering, danger, and death. They accepted his guidance because he was with them and his words of courage and comfort sustained them. Even when, in the final bitterness, they faltered, he was eager to welcome them back to his side, stronger and wiser for their experience. The centuries have passed and the times have changed, but the principle of sacrifice and service remains, and, though our mortal limitations have imposed the conditions of faith, the assurance of the nearness and love of our Lord is with us still. Their way to the south lay through Samaria, and Jesus sent messengers before them into a village to make provision for his little company. The Feast of Tabernacles was over, and the Feast of Dedication was near. These were times when the Samaritans, never well disposed towards the Jews, turned deliberately hostile. Pilgrims to Jerusalem, as we have seen, usually avoided Samaria. So it was that Jesus found these people less friendly than the people of Sychar had once been. The messengers returned to say that they would not receive him. For the first time, James and John reveal the quality which had given them the name Sons of Thunder. "Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, even as Elias did?" It is interesting to notice that these vengeful and even bitter words followed so quickly after their master's judgment of their own cities. Capernaum and Bethsaida had never refused Jesus this hospitality. Indeed, the people had always welcomed him back joyfully from his travels through Galilee. If they had merited divine retribution, how much more the Samaritan village, which refused to receive him and to accord him the ordinary courtesies of Oriental custom. With this was undoubtedly mingled a feeling of anger at this insult to their Lord. Their language possibly suggests, too, that the experience on Hermon was still fresh in their minds. But Jesus rebuked them. His anger was not against the villages who had refused him, but against these two disciples who, after so many lessons of his love, had still not caught the spirit of his ministry. "You know not what manner of spirit you are of, for the Son of Man has not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." Jesus did not, of course, imply any criticism of Elijah's action. The prophet's mission was to exercise the righteous judgment of God. Wrath and punishment are as much prerogatives of God as love and mercy. But the coming into the world of the Son of God was a dispensation of love, and while that dispensation remained, love prevailed. The time would come when men's refusal to accept this ministration would again bring wrath. Meanwhile, the people of the Samaritan village brought judgment upon themselves. Their sick and blind could have been healed. They remained sick and blind. The eyes of their understanding were dark, but they received no light. Jesus went on to another village.